Animals Make Us Human, Disc 3.
Purebreds versus Mutts. My friend thinks part of the problem her mixed-breed dog was having with the dogs they met on walks might be that most of those dogs were purebreds. Many times she would notice a purebred dog bounding up to her mutt, not seeming to notice that her dog's body was stiff and his hackles were raised. Sometimes the owners seemed pretty oblivious, too. Dr. Goodwin's study, showing that purebred dogs have lost a lot of the natural submissive behaviors of wolves, might mean that my friend's dog really was being provoked by at least some of the purebred dogs, lots of labs, quite a few small terrier breeds, a few golden retrievers and poodles, they met on walks. The purpose of submission signals from one wolf to another is to keep the peace. The message is, I don't want to fight. But my friend's dog was constantly being approached face to face by dogs showing very few polite, submissive behaviors. It was obvious these dogs didn't want to fight her dog because they always acted surprised and frightened when her dog attacked. But they seemed to have lost most of their ancestors' ways to signal their peaceful intentions. I wonder whether some purebred dogs haven't lost not only the ability to do some wolf behaviors, but also the ability to read some standard wolf behaviors. Is it possible some purebred dogs don't know what raised hackles mean? Another question is whether mutts might be more anxious than purebreds in general. Mutts may be closer to wolves genetically, because as soon as purebred dogs mate outside their breed, they start to develop physical features more similar to those of wolves, pointier noses, darker fur if the breed is yellow or white, and so on. If mutts are also more similar to wolves behaviorally, they're going to be more anxious than a lot of purebreds because wolves are extremely shy. Wolves are so shy that researchers have been able to crawl inside a wolf den and handle the cubs while the wolf mom and dad hide from the humans. Dogs are much less shy than wolves, which is almost the definition of a dog versus a wolf. Wild animals that have been domesticated are less shy around humans than their wild counterparts, or they'd still be wild. So, by definition, mutts can't be as shy as wolves. But mutts may be shyer overall than purebreds. There's some research to support this. Greg Ackland at Cornell crossbred shy Siberian huskies with two generations of beagles and got two very shy male dogs in the second litter. He interpreted his results to mean that shyness appears to be transmitted as a dominant trait. If shyness is a dominant trait, then mutts should start to regain that trait as they crossbreed. Dogs are individuals. For years, dog owners have been told that any dog can bite. Owners are supposed to be super vigilant about establishing dominance over their dogs because the dogs might become dangerous if they don't. But telling people that any dog can bite is very misleading because it lumps all dogs together. The chances of a completely normal, well-socialized dog that hasn't been traumatized as a puppy biting a person are tiny. Dogs have different personalities, different temperaments, and different biologies. I'm sure we'll find out that aggressive dogs have a different neurological makeup from non-aggressive dogs. In her textbook, Dr. Overall writes about the results of an unpublished study she and her colleagues did at the Veterinary Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, VHUP. They tested the urine of 210 aggressive dogs and compared it to the urine of 84 non-aggressive dogs. 88% of the aggressive dogs had metabolic abnormalities compared to only 23% of the non-aggressive dogs. The most common abnormalities were very high levels of glutamine, taurine, and alanine. Glutamine and taurine are excitatory neurotransmitters and high levels of glutamine have been associated with high levels of aggression running through human families. Criminal dogs. You have to know your dog, and you have to know your dog as an individual, not just as a member of a particular breed. Pit bulls are a good example of how important it is to take each dog as an individual. Pit bulls were originally bred to fight other dogs, but never to attack humans. Any pit bull that attacked humans was put down, and its genes were taken out of the gene pool. Today, there are illegal breeders and gang lords who are deliberately breeding the nice-to-people characteristic of pit bulls out by crossing people-aggressive dogs with dog-aggressive pit bulls. I saw one videotape of 8-week-old puppies that were already fighting viciously. That's totally abnormal. These people are deliberately breeding criminal dogs. An animal shelter lady told me even the rescue group people can't handle these dogs and are bringing them back to the shelters. I also learned about a litter of puppies sired by a vicious pit bull. The young puppies were adopted out to different families, and they were all returned for biting. Some communities hear stories like this and conclude that pit bulls should be outlawed. But outlawing a particular breed is never the answer because it's so easy to breed dogs for aggression. If you make pit bulls illegal, unethical breeders will just breed other dogs for aggression, and it won't take them long to come up with an animal that's genetically built to be nasty. This has already started to happen. Akitas and Chows are being crossed with other aggressive breeds to create killer dogs. All you can do with this kind of information is use it as a check on the individual dog you're interested in buying or adopting to make sure he hasn't been affected by bad breeders. How to spot an easy dog. Before I talk about easy dogs, I want to make sure everyone knows that any normal dog can be a great pet, including fearful, shy, and anxious dogs. Sometimes, not always. These dogs take more work, but they're great companions. If you want a dog with an easygoing temperament, you can give any dog a quick personality test before you buy or adopt it. A lot of different personality tests have been developed. One of the easiest for most people to use would be what Patricia McConnell does to test a puppy's temperament. After she spends some time getting to know a puppy, here's how she tests his emotional makeup. My favorite exercise with a young pup is to gently roll her over onto her back and then lightly restrain her with a hand on her chest. I let my hand rest lightly on her until she begins to try to get up, and then I'll use just enough pressure to keep her from doing so. Pay attention to what the pup does when you let him go. I've seen puppies who have rolled over, nailed me with one of those looks-could-kill expressions, and refused to come near me again. That's not the dog I want, because I love dogs and people who don't take life too seriously. Neither do I want a dog who is so stressed by the procedure that his eyes round in terror. My favorite dog is the one who takes the whole thing as a silly game. This approach tests a puppy for excessive fear and for excessive anger. It tests for fear because grown dogs and wolves never roll each other over unless they're in a really bad fight. Even though Dr. McConnell does it very gently, it's still potentially a scary thing to do to a dog. It tests for anger because anger comes from the experience of being restrained. And it tests for an easygoing nature because any puppy that is confident and calm enough to think that being rolled over and lightly held down is all a big game is going to be a very good-natured dog. End-of-life issues. It's often difficult to make the right decision about care for pets who are nearing the end of life. How do you determine when euthanizing a pet is the right thing to do? When is it right to perform a painful, invasive treatment? And when is it right to choose a simpler treatment that will reduce pain and improve the quality of the animal's remaining life? When you're faced with these questions, you need time to think carefully and have discussions with friends and family. If you are informed at the veterinarian's office that your pet has cancer or some other serious disease, the options for treatments vary widely. I strongly recommend taking your time to make a decision. In a non-emergency situation, bring your pet home and take several days to decide what to do. You need time to get over the shock so you can make a good decision. Discussing all the possible options and getting a second opinion from another veterinarian may also be a good idea. You must remember that animals are not able to understand that a painful treatment could prolong their life. They just feel the fear and pain. You need to look at the quality of the animal's life. Would a complicated, invasive treatment improve the quality of your pet's life? There are also financial realities that require good judgment. Most important, you must make sure that your choice does not prolong suffering. What dogs need: play and seeking. Dog fears and aggression can be hard to figure out sometimes, but dog joy isn't. Just about anyone who's lived with a dog knows what dogs like. In terms of the core emotions, dogs need social contact so their panic system doesn't get activated, games and play with their owners to activate the seeking system, interesting things to do, especially long walks, that arouse their seeking system. We've already talked about a dog's social needs. Dogs should not be left alone all day long, cooped up in a house or an apartment, and they certainly shouldn't be left inside a crate for hours on end. If the house is going to be empty during the day, you should either buy another dog or find a good doggy daycare, or both. Another good arrangement would be to leave your dog with a neighbor who stays home during the day. Patricia McConnell says dogs need social companionship almost as much as they need food and water. Dogs especially need the play system to be stimulated because they never grow up all the way. All juvenile animals play more than adults, so if you can afford it, you should buy plenty of toys for your dog, and you should rotate the toys the same way people rotate toys for their kids. Old toys are boring, new toys are fun. That's the rule. You should also play with your dog every day. If your dog likes to chase balls, that's great. If he likes to play tug of war, that's another good game. Dogs probably have high seeking needs because they're descended from wolves, and wolves are nomadic animals that get a lot of mental stimulation during the day and make a lot of decisions. There is nothing dogs like more than a long walk, unless it's getting loose outside the yard and taking off for a day on their own or with a doggy friend. A friend of mine once ran into her dog when he and the neighbor dog were on the loose. She was riding bikes with her 11-year-old son, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there were the two dogs running along beside them. The dogs greeted them with huge, relaxed, open-mouthed dog grins, ran alongside them for a little way, then took off up a hill, running as fast as they could. They looked like they were having the time of their lives. Since dogs don't have many opportunities to roam free these days, it's up to you to give your dog enough mental stimulation to keep his mind busy. Dogs have to have a daily walk, and I think it's a good idea to take those walks someplace where your dogs can be off-leash if possible. They'll get a lot more exercise and do a lot more investigating and exploring that way, which is what they need to activate the seeking system. Patricia McConnell says dogs need at least an hour a day of attention from their owners, and that's just the average. Working breeds need huge amounts of exercise. Your 1 hour a day could be a 1 hour walk, or if you don't have the energy for that, you could break it down into three parts. A half hour walk, 15 minutes of play, and 15 minutes learning new tricks. Teaching dogs new tricks is especially important for exercising their minds and activating the seeking emotion. Some high-energy dogs love to do agility training, and you may want to join a local dog training group or set up some equipment such as jumps and tunnels in your yard. Dogs need people, play, and lots of opportunities to explore and learn, and they can't provide these things for themselves. That's your job. Chapter 3. Cats. The big difference between cats and dogs is that cats aren't hypersocial. You can't use social approval to train a cat, and cats don't train themselves by picking up on their owner's reactions the way dogs sometimes do. Dogs serve people, but people serve cats. On the other hand, cats are not solitary, self-sufficient loners the way a lot of people think. Cats have social needs. Unfortunately, we animal behaviorists and ethologists don't know as much about cats and their emotions as we do about other domestic animals. But a lot of what we do know hasn't gotten out to the public. One of the most important things to realize about cats is that they haven't really been domesticated, at least not nearly to the degree dogs have. Wolves started evolving into dogs 100,000 years ago. No one knows for sure yet when wild cats started to evolve into domestic cats. The oldest cat remains found in the grave of a human are 9,500 years old. That was after agriculture was invented in some parts of the world, so humans were past the hunter-gatherer stage. They were living in towns and villages when they started to associate with cats. The most popular theory of how cats became domestic animals is that they joined human settlements to prey on rats and mice. Basically, they made themselves into pets. This theory may not be right, though. James Serple, Associate Professor of Humane Ethics and Animal Welfare and Director of the Center for the Interaction of Animals and Society at the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine, thinks hunter-gatherers may have had cats too. Archaeologists found a cat jaw in one of the first human settlements on Cyprus when agriculture was just being invented. If the very earliest villages had cats, then hunter-gatherers probably had cats, too. Dr. Serple says that the few hunter-gatherers who are still alive today like to capture young wild animals and care for them, which is evidence that animal keeping has always been practiced by humans. Contemporary hunter-gatherers take really good care of these animals, don't eat them, and mourn them when they die. If Dr. Serple is right, cats and people could go back a very long way. But even if cats and people have lived together for thousands and thousands of years, cats probably haven't been changed that much by their association with people because cats and humans had a mutualistic relationship instead of the more symbiotic relationship humans and dogs had during domestication. Early humans needed their dogs to guard their camps and help them hunt, and early dogs needed their humans for food and shelter. They depended on each other. With people and cats, it was more a relationship of convenience. Cats killed mice and rats, and humans provided lots of mice and rats to kill, since mice and rats lived in human settlements. The two species didn't need each other so much as profit by being around each other. The result was that today a house cat is a lot closer to a wild cat than a dog is to a wolf. To understand why, you need to know how domestication works. The first wolves who started to live with humans would have been less fearful of humans than other wolves. Those less fearful wolves would have been fed by humans, which would have given them a reproductive advantage over their brother and sister wolves who still had to find all their own food. That created a selection pressure for tameness. For example, if the slower antelopes are the ones that get eaten by the lion, the faster antelopes will be more successful at breeding and will leave behind more offspring because they live longer. After a few generations, if the slow antelopes keep getting eaten at higher rates than the fast antelopes, antelopes will become faster as a species. Selection pressure is the mechanism through which animals evolve. Humans who kept wolves would have gotten a reproductive advantage too, because they had wolves guarding them while they slept and helping them hunt. After a few generations, the less fearful wolves would be on the path to becoming domestic dogs, and the humans would probably have been on their way to becoming a species that likes to live with dogs. Cats would have had less selection pressure to lose their fear of humans than wolves did, partly because the African wild cat, which is the ancestor of the domestic cat, has a lot less fear of humans than wolves do. There have been reports for 150 years of African wildcats living on the edges of villages and of the people in the villages capturing the cats as kittens, taming them, and using them to catch rats and mice. Europeans also wrote about taming wild cats and keeping them to catch rats. The African cat didn't have to change very much to be willing to live as a house cat. Cats did change in some ways. All domestic animals have smaller brains than their wild ancestor animals, and domestic cats also have smaller brains than wild cats, although we don't know very much about the differences at this point. Domestic animals also undergo pedomorphosis, or neoteny, and adult house cats have three juvenile behaviors, meowing, purring, and kneading their paws. Adult wild cats living in zoos don't do these things with humans, although they do purr with other cats. Other than that, though, cats are less neotenized than other domestic animals, and they can easily go feral and survive. That's not true for dogs. If you put the family poodle out in the countryside, his chances of surviving are low unless he finds another family to live with. But abandoned cats do fine. They're healthier living with people because they get veterinary care, but they don't need to find another family to survive. They're still adapted to living in the wild and taking care of themselves. There was a second set of selection pressures on wolves and early dogs that cats didn't have, which was that humans started preferring wolves that were especially good at guarding the settlement or going on hunting parties with them. That would have started dogs down the path of becoming specialized for work. Cats weren't big enough to guard the humans from big predators, so there wouldn't have been any selection pressures turning them into guard cats, and there wasn't any reason for humans to choose the best mice and rat killers because all cats naturally kill mice and rats and any other small prey they can catch. Even without knowing anything about the history of the domestic cat's evolution, you can tell from the cat's appearance and behavior that cats haven't changed as much as the other domestic animals have. In appearance, domesticated animals are much more varied than their wild counterparts. Dogs have huge variability, ranging all the way from tiny toy breeds to Alaskan Malamutes. Cats don't come in anything like this kind of variety. They've evolved some different coat colors, but most people looking at photographs of wild African cats wouldn't be able to tell them apart from a standard tabby cat. There are at least three reasons why domesticated animals have more variability in appearance, which probably apply more weakly to cats than to the other domestic animals. First, humans usually protect domesticated animals from predators, so selection pressures for protective colorings go down because genes for coat colors that make the animal easier to see don't get culled out of the gene pool. Second, the genes for appearance are usually connected to behavior in some way, So as different behaviors develop in a domesticating animal, appearance changes too. I'll talk more about the relationship between a cat's coat coloring and its behavior later on. The third reason why there's so much variability in domesticated species is that humans deliberately breed domesticated species to be more variable. That's the second stage of domestication. At first, domestication happens naturally when some of the animals living with humans, the good guard dogs and the good hunting dogs, reproduce more successfully than others, the guard dogs and hunting dogs that got killed. Then, once humans developed selective breeding techniques, they began to breed differences into domestic animals on purpose. Dogs and horses were bred to do particular jobs. Cows, goats, sheep, and chickens were bred for production traits such as how fast they grew, how much meat and fat they had, and so on. People have been selectively breeding cats only for the past 150 years or so, and purebred cats are being bred for appearance traits instead of work or production traits. There's also a big behavioral difference between cats and the other domestic animals, which is that you can't train a cat using punishment and negative reinforcement. That makes cats more like wild animals than dogs or horses or cows. Karen Pryor has a really good description of how wild animals react to punishment or force. Anyone who has ever kept a wild, undomesticated animal for a pet knows that they're more difficult to train. It's extraordinarily difficult, for example, to teach a wolf to walk on a leash, even if you have raised it from puppyhood and it is quite tame. If you pull, it pulls back automatically, and if you are too insistent and pull too hard, the wolf, no matter how calm and sociable it usually is, panics and tries to escape. Put a tame pet otter on a leash, and either you go where the otter wants to go, or it fights the leash with all its might. Dolphins are the same. Push a dolphin, and it pushes back. Try to herd dolphins from one tank to another with nets. If they feel crowded, bold individuals will charge the net, and timid ones will sink to the tank bottom in helpless fear. The only way to train a wild animal is to use positive reinforcement. Positive reinforcement means rewarding the animal for doing the things you're training it to do. Cats are the same way, which is probably why people have always thought cats weren't trainable. Traditional animal training relies on punishment and negative reinforcement. The punishments and negative reinforcements might be extremely mild, but they're still negative. For example, putting a collar on a puppy and pulling on the leash to get him to walk with you creates a slightly unpleasant pressure on the puppy's neck. The puppy learns to walk forward to get away from the pressure. That's what negative reinforcement is. An animal or person is reinforced by having something negative, pressure on the neck, stop. I'll talk more about the difference between punishment and negative reinforcement in the next chapter. You can't train a cat to walk on a leash by putting a collar on it and dragging on the leash. But you can train a cat to walk on a leash by using positive reinforcement. I'll explain how later on. What it all comes down to is that a cat in a person's house isn't all that different from a cat on the Serengeti Plains. Nicholas Dodman, the veterinary researcher who wrote The Cat Who Cried for Help, says, "A cat is in some ways like a miniature tiger in your living room." Cats are hard to read. I started out this chapter by saying cats are more social than most people realize. One of the reasons people haven't picked up on cat sociability is that domestic cats aren't totally domesticated the way dogs and horses are. They can go their own way. Quite a few cats do go. A friend of mine told me that her favorite cat when she was growing up, a big striped tomcat named King, moved to the neighbor's house down the road. They'd see him every once in a while when he came back to visit, but otherwise he stayed with the neighbors. My friend grew up on a farm where all the cats were barn cats, so her parents figured King must have gotten promoted to house cat with his new family. He had a better offer and he took it. A dog would never do that. The other reason people see cats as being more solitary than they are is that cats have less in common with people as a species than either dogs or wolves do, regardless of domestication. Wolves live in families with a similar structure to the human family, and wolves' communication is probably a lot more like human communication than cat communication is. Wolves communicate heavily through vision, and their faces are very expressive. Thanks to domestication, dogs also make lots of different sounds people interpret pretty well. For instance, the reason dogs talk, or bark, is because they evolved to live with people, and people communicate through sounds. Wolves are mostly silent. Adult wolves almost never bark. Dogs also read humans well. There's a lot of research on that. Cats are completely different, and I think their differences make them difficult for people to read. The hardest thing for people is that cats don't have expressive faces. Humans naturally look at an animal's face to see what it's thinking because people are primates, and primates use their faces to communicate. Some anthropologists think facial expressions are more important than words, even. Looking at an animal's face works just fine with a dog, although you need to look at its posture and its tail, too. But cats don't signal with their faces very much, and they have lots more bodily signals than either dogs or wolves do. So when people look into their cats' faces, they're looking at the wrong place. Another interesting thing about cat faces, cats don't have eyebrows the way people and a lot of dogs do. Eyebrows probably evolved to highlight facial expressions, and a lot of dark-furred dogs have little round light spots right over their eyes that may have evolved for the same reason. I think the cat's inexpressive face is one of the reasons some people think autistic kids are like cats. There's even a book called All Cats Have Asperger's Syndrome. Cats seem autistic because they don't come across as being sociable or eager to please like dogs, and also because their faces are kind of blank. Autistic people often have somewhat blank faces, too. Cats probably don't read people's faces very well, either. In his book about cats, The Cat Who Cried for Help, Nick Dodman has a story about a cat who was badly scared one day when he saw a man beat his dog right outside the sliding glass window that the cat was sitting next to. The man was tall, thin, and had a beard. Later that day, the cat attacked his owner, who was also tall, thin, and had a beard, so it's possible he mistook his owner for the other man. A dog wouldn't have made that mistake. The final reason people have trouble understanding cats is that humans probably can't even perceive a huge number of the signals cats make. Cats use smells to communicate with each other, and humans have a terrible sense of smell compared to cats. Researchers say cats may have as good a sense of smell as dogs, who can smell things at a threshold 1,000 times lower than people can. Of course, everyone can smell it when a cat has been spraying the furniture, but there are probably all kinds of subtler smell signals inside those big, horrible smells that other cats can pick up on, but we can't. Cats definitely communicate with other cats by leaving odors humans can't smell. They have at least 2 ways to do this. 1. Cats have glands on their paws that leave a deposit whenever they scratch an object. 2. Cats also have facial glands that leave deposits when they rub against things. Dogs mark by peeing on stuff, but that's all. They don't rub up against people or knead people with their paws to leave their scent. Given the fact that cats do so much talking in smells, it isn't really surprising that the number one behavior problem cat owners go to vets for help with is elimination disorders. That brings me to the core emotion systems in the brain. The blue ribbon emotions in cats, the fear system. Fear can be a big problem for cats, which is probably why we have the expression scaredy cat. A lot of house cats are so afraid of strangers that they hide anytime someone comes to visit. I wonder whether this is because cats are genetically closer to their wild counterparts. A wild animal is afraid of people. That's one of the things that makes it wild. It's possible cats naturally have more fear of humans than dogs do because they're not as fully domesticated. It's easy to tell when a cat is afraid. Fearful cats avoid the thing they're afraid of however they can. A house cat runs and hides. At the zoo, when the big cats are afraid, they refuse to go out to the exhibit area. A cat who is only feeling fear doesn't puff out his hair, arch his back, and spit. That's an angry cat. The fear system can activate the rage system in all animals and people, so a frightened cat can become enraged. But as long as he's only feeling fear, he doesn't puff up his hair or attack. Three different studies have found that cats can be divided into two personality categories, bold and shy. The researchers who did the three studies called the bold cats confident, easygoing, sociable, and trusting. They described the fearful cats as timid, nervous, shy, and unfriendly. Boldness and friendliness go together. Bold cats are faster to approach a novel object than shy cats, and they're friendlier to people. So if you want a naturally friendly cat, later I'll talk about things you can do to make a shy cat friendlier, you could consider getting a cat from a breed that's known for being friendly. The Siamese breed is a good bet. In one survey of people who owned Siamese cats, Persian cats, or non-pedigree cats, both the Siamese and the Persian were ranked as being friendlier than the domestic cats. The authors of the survey also observed the owners with their cats and found the same differences the owners reported. If you're going to get a domestic cat, there are three things you can do to obtain a cat with a friendly, bold temperament. 1. Get a kitten and make sure lots of people gently handle it when it's tiny. The sensitive period for socialization is the second week of a kitten's life to the seventh week, and the more people who handle the kitten during this time, the better. This is very important because it's so easy for cats to go feral. My friend Mark's cat once had kittens underneath the house where he couldn't find them. By the time he finally discovered where they were, the kittens were way over 2 months old and were super wild. He couldn't handle them. I've seen the opposite happen, too. I went to a livestock auction on a day they weren't having a sale, and I found a mama cat and her kittens living underneath the auctioneer's stand. Those kittens had been handled by everyone at the auctions, and they were the friendliest, cutest little kittens. Kittens need a lot of friendly human handling during the sensitive period. Handling won't turn a genetically shy cat into a completely friendly one, though. At least two different studies show that shyness is inherited, and although you can reduce it some, you can't totally reverse it. 2. If you adopt a kitten from a shelter, pick one that is friendly. I've gone to a number of animal shelters and visited the cats. If I put my hand in the cage, some kitties come right up to me and rub me while other kitties huddle in the back. The kitty that comes right up to you is the kitty you want. A lot of shelters have a room where you can get to know the animal, so you can watch to see how a cat acts when you take him into the room. If the cat lets you hold him, that's a good sign. You could also take a cat toy in to see whether the cat plays with it. There's a wonderful little cat toy I really like, a little feather duster attached to a flexible 18-inch wand. Cats just love it. 3. Adopt a black cat. Sarah Hartwell, a shelter worker in England, calls black cats laid-back blacks and tortoiseshell cats naughty torties. That description is supported by a handful of studies showing a relationship between fur color and behavior. Black cats especially are friendlier than other cats, are better able to deal with crowding and urban life, and have greater aggregative tendencies, which means they're more inclined to live in groups of cats. Black cats are more social overall, whether it's with other cats or with humans. Black fur on cats has an interesting history. Black fur coloring is caused by recessive genes. For anyone who's forgotten high school biology, a recessive gene has to be inherited from both parents if the offspring is going to have the trait. Blue eyes are caused by a recessive gene. The black fur gene has evolved 4 different times in 4 different cat species. Obviously, black fur, or the traits associated with black fur, gives cats an important survival advantage. Stephen J. O'Brien with the Feline Genome Project thinks the mutation that causes black fur might make cats resistant to viruses in the HIV family. Other studies have found that orange male cats are more aggressive than black male cats. That's logical because orange cats are shyer than black cats, and you would expect fearful cats to have more fear aggression. I've noticed that neutered orange males and females can be very affectionate. Some orange cats will rub on you all day. However, orange cats startle and scare easily. The black cat's calmer nature might explain why there are so many black cats around, even though the gene for black fur is recessive. Black cats that live in cities are more successful at mating than orange cats because orange cats spend too much time fighting the other tomcats, whereas the black cats patiently wait their turn to mate. It's different out in the country, where there aren't as many cats around. Orange cats have an advantage in rural areas because they can monopolize the local females without having to fight a lot of other male cats. Country cats observe a form of polygyny, which means having more than one wife at the same time, whereas city cats are mostly promiscuous. Different genetics work well in different situations. Fur color isn't a guarantee that a cat will have one kind of personality or another. So, adopting a black kitten doesn't mean you've definitely got a cat that likes to live in groups, including groups of humans. When you choose a kitten, you have to go by the individual personality of the kitten, regardless of color. Preventing fear at the vet's office. The most frightening place for cats, even bold ones, is the vet's office. To keep a cat calm for medical exams and treatments, you handle it the same way good stock people handle a cow, using the principles of restraint I developed for cattle. No sudden jerky motions. Use calm, steady movement. No slippery metal tops on the examining table. I tell people to bring a bath mat with a rubber backing from home to put on the table. Slipping causes panic in all animals. Stroke your cat firmly as a way of applying deep pressure. Do not use pats or light tickle touches. A student once came up to me after I finished my lecture and said he worked as a veterinary aide. Everyone at his clinic called him the kitty whisperer, he told me, because he was the only person who could calm the cats down when they came in for their appointments. The secret of his success was my principles of restraint for cattle, which he'd read about in Animals in Translation. He tried applying them to cats, and they worked. Kittens and cats should be trained to feel that a cat carrier is a safe place. Food treats can be fed in the carrier, and your cat should be gradually taught to tolerate being locked in the carrier for a longer and longer time. This prevents the car ride to the vet from being a yowling, frightening experience. Your cat should become fully accustomed to the cat carrier before he has to go to the vet or go on a car trip. When I was a child, we did everything wrong when traveling to our summer house with Bee Lee. Both my mother and I thought that Bee Lee would travel easily like our dog, who just hopped into the car so he could be with us. But Bee Lee had never been trained to stay in a carrier, and he ripped apart the flimsy cardboard box I had put him in. On another trip, he clawed Mother's head as she was driving down the freeway. Mother had him riding loose because he yowled in the carrier. She mistakenly thought he would be calmer when loose. A bad experience like this can create a permanent fear memory and make it very difficult to train a cat to travel calmly in a carrier. Cats that have had a scary travel experience will probably need tranquilizers before their next trip. Elimination disorders. Most marking behavior in cats comes from anxiety, which is related to the fear system. Dr. Dodman says that when cats are anxious about something, they become insecure and develop a strong need to redefine their territory. Male cats are usually the problem markers, but female cats can also develop elimination disorders due to inappropriate marking. Dr. Dodman says you can tell what a cat is anxious about by noticing the areas it's marking. He's had a few clients whose cats marked them. One lady's cat urinated right in her face while she was lying in bed. The cat was also peeing on the lady's clothes, backpack, and purse. The cat was upset because the lady's boyfriend had moved in with her. Dr. Dodman told her that the cat was marking her and things that belonged to her to let the world know that you are hers. The cat completely changed on Buspar, an anti-anxiety medication. She stopped marking her owner's things, and she started liking the new boyfriend and playing with him. Cats can get interstitial cystitis, which is similar to the kind of urinary tract infections people get. However, when Dr. Overall studied cats with cystitis at the Veterinary Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, she found that only 15% of them also had behavior elimination disorders. The rest were using their litter boxes just fine. The antidepressant Elavil has been a standard treatment for cystitis. Nick Dodman says this might mean that interstitial cystitis is related to anxiety. Elimination disorders come in at least three different varieties: spraying furniture and rugs, defecating outside the litter box, defecating and urinating outside the litter box. Each category has a set of subcategories too, such as substrate aversion, the cat develops an aversion to the kind of kitty litter its owner buys, and location aversion, the cat develops an aversion to where the litter box is. 40 to 75% of all cats brought to the vet for problem behaviors are spraying, urinating, and or defecating in the wrong place. A cat can decide it doesn't like its litter box for a lot of different reasons, which I'll talk about in the next section. A lot of these problems are easy to fix by doing the following. Change the substrate. Some cats prefer sand-like kitty litter, and others hate strong deodorant smells. Change the location of the litter box. Your cat may think the box is too exposed or too far away from the rest of the house. As an example, a cat probably wouldn't be happy having its litter box way up in the attic or in a far corner of the basement next to the noisy furnace. Change the flooring under the litter box. Cats don't like the plastic mats people put under the box to protect the floor, possibly because they move too easily. All animals intensely dislike slippery or unsure footing. Any unstable flooring will frighten an animal. Change the litter more frequently. If you have more than one cat, make sure you have enough litter boxes for all of them, preferably one box per cat. If you have more than one cat, put each cat's litter box in a different room. Change the type of litter box. Some cats like boxes with hoods and some don't. Up until recently, people had no idea how complex a behavior an elimination disorder is. Cat owners tended to see spraying and peeing or pooping in the wrong place as a nuisance, a lot more than a nuisance in severe cases, somewhat like the nuisance of having an untrained puppy in the house. But it's really an emotional problem. An elimination disorder can mean different things at different times. A cat that poops by the door, for instance, may have seen a stranger cat outside. That turns on the fear system, and the cat poops to mark its territory and lower its fear by marking out a safety zone. Marking territory, for cats, and dogs too, is probably like putting up a backyard fence for humans. An ordinary fence won't keep really bad guys out, and everyone knows it. A fence is a social signal that tells law-abiding people this space belongs to you. Cat obsessions and compulsions. Cats have high levels of OCD-like behavior that I'm loosely classifying with the fear system, because OCD has traditionally been classified with anxiety disorders in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and because people with OCD experience a huge amount of anxiety and fear. However, there's a lot going on in OCD research, and the classification may be changing. Dr. Panksepp says obsessive-compulsive thoughts and behaviors could be related to overarousal of the seeking system. A lot of people think obsessive behaviors are hardwired survival behaviors, such as grooming, that have gotten out of control somehow. Until we know more, I'm going to assume that the cat's very small frontal lobes compared to the rest of its brain have something to do with it. A human being's frontal lobes, which sit behind the forehead, take up 29% of the brain. A dog's frontal lobes are 7% of its brain, and a cat's frontal lobes are just 3.5%. The frontal lobes are important to the executive functions, planning, organizing, staying on track, and changing actions and plans easily and smoothly. It's that last one that obsessive people and cats have trouble with. They get stuck on one behavior or thought and can't shift to a different one. Cats tend to be set in their ways, much more so than dogs, and a lot of times they don't adapt well to new circumstances. I know of one small shelter where they have about 40 cats, all housed together inside one medium-sized room with cages along the walls, mostly with the doors left open. There's a big island, like a kitchen island, in the middle. The shelter lady tells people not even to try to adopt the adult cats living there because they always end up being brought back. The cats have formed a colony, and the room is the colony's home. They don't want to leave. That doesn't mean you can never adopt an adult cat. But a cat that has spent just a few weeks at a shelter will probably have an easier time adjusting to a new house. Cats get intensely attached to their homes, too. My aunt had a cat on her ranch who had a terrible time adapting when my aunt moved to a new house 5 miles away. The cat kept running away and going back to the old house, which was empty. Each time he ran away, my aunt would go get him and bring him back until finally the cat stayed. I talked to another lady, though, whose cat never did get used to the new house. The cat kept running away back to the old house until finally the new people who'd moved in said they'd adopt her so she could keep on living where she wanted to. Cats can be obsessive about their surroundings, too. A man told me that his indoor cat notices every tiny little change in the environment and will stand by a dripping faucet until someone comes and turns it off. Many cats refuse to drink water out of their water bowls. Sometimes this is due to a dirty bowl. They have to drink water straight out of the tap. Someone else told me their cat will only drink water out of a pan they keep under the bathtub faucet because the faucet has a drip. I think cat obsessions may be one reason why so many cats get into predicaments they can't get back out of. They get mentally stuck. I had to rescue our cat, Bee Lee, from underneath the dishwasher one time when he couldn't change course and go back the way he came. We had an old-fashioned dishwasher where the whole dishwasher tray pulled out like a big drawer, the way a trash compactor pulls out. Someone had left the dishwasher drawer pulled all the way out, and Bee Lee went through the sink cabinet and crawled all the way up under the drawer. Then he just kept trying to go forward and get out into the kitchen, even though the space between the floor and the decorative panel at the bottom of the dishwasher was only about an inch high. His paws were sticking out, and he was yowling because he couldn't get the rest of his body out. His seeking emotion made him go under the dishwasher to explore the environment. But when he reached the front of the dishwasher, he couldn't put himself in reverse. The sight of the kitchen floor up ahead was pulling him forward. I had to slowly push the drawer in all the way to make him back up to the wall. Once I pushed him most of the way back to the wall, he went back under the sink cabinet and got out. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that a lot of elimination disorders have OCD-like qualities. A cat gets anxious about its litter box or about an invader cat, starts pooping and peeing outside its box, and then can't stop pooping and peeing outside its box. Rage. In Animals in Translation, I wrote about cat explosions that happen in veterinary clinics when an indoor cat sees a dog for the first time and freaks out. I saw a chart where someone had written, "Assistant was carrying cat down hall when cat exploded." The lady who does my webpage, Julie, was bitten down to the bone and had to be on antibiotics for 6 weeks when her cat saw a dog. In those two cases, the cats probably went from calm to intense fear to intense rage because the fear system can activate the rage system. That's why anti-anxiety medication can help cure a case of inter-cat aggression. Cats can go from calm to terrified or enraged in seconds because they have small frontal lobes, and the frontal lobes are the brain's brakes. They inhibit emotion. Small frontal lobes also make it hard for a Halloween kitty with all its hair standing on end to calm back down. The cat who attacked his owner because he looked like the bad man who beat his dog had been upset for 2 hours when his owner came home and he hadn't relaxed at all. It was a really vicious attack, so bad that the owner had to run upstairs to get away from his own cat. Cats are so violent when their rage system is activated, and they stay aroused for so long, that if you have more than one cat in the household, you have to be careful never to let them get into a scratching, clawing fight. Cat fights are horrible, and one bad fight will likely lead to more fights. One summer when I was a child, my mother woke up to find our cat, Bee Lee, in a knockdown, drag-out fight with a tomcat on her bed. The tomcat had come in through the window, and the two cats were ripping each other apart. I don't want to scare anyone out of getting more than one cat. Cats need companions, and most cats live peacefully with each other. But cat owners should be prepared to handle a fight, because under the wrong circumstances, two cats that get along perfectly well can attack each other. The term for this is redirected aggression. Redirected aggression happens when a cat is prevented from attacking one cat, and so it attacks another cat or person instead. Dr. Dodman's two cats, a mother and a daughter, had an episode of redirected aggression once. The cats were totally attached to each other and slept curled up together at night. Then one day, the mama saw a stranger cat sitting on the deck just outside the screen door. She puffed up into Halloween Kitty and attacked her own daughter, presumably because she couldn't get to the other cat. The cat who attacked his owner was also doing redirected aggression. Dr. Dodman separated his two cats as soon as the fight broke out by shooing both of them into another room. Then he shooed the daughter cat into a back staircase, shut the door, and left the cats separated overnight. The next morning, they were fine. If cats that live together get into a serious fight and you can't break it up in time, it's not easy to get the cats back together, though it can be done. If the aggression has been mild, Dr. Deborah Horowitz, a cat behavior specialist in St. Louis, Missouri, advises putting a bell on the more aggressive cat's collar. That can break the cycle of fighting because the victim cat can hear the other cat coming and calmly move away. If the aggression has been more serious, you can reintroduce the cats by putting the more aggressive cat inside a cat carrier and letting the victim cat go into the room. If the aggressive cat starts hissing and spitting, Dr. Horowitz says you should throw a blanket over the carrier. Never put the victim in the carrier because the aggressive cat will intimidate it. If those approaches don't work, you might have to start a very gradual desensitization program that can last for many weeks. You should definitely also consider medication for the cats. Dr. Dodman has successfully used Buspar, an anti-anxiety medication, even with cats whose fighting had gotten so out of control they didn't respond to months of behavior modification. We had two cats who didn't like each other when I was growing up. Bee Lee, a neutered male Siamese cat, and Bootsy, a black and white female mongrel. Bee Lee was 6 years old when we got Bootsy, who was around three. They got into a knockdown, drag-out fight. And after that, we kept the peace by having Bee Lee live upstairs and Bootsy live downstairs. Also, we built a gate on the front stairs that seemed to help. The cats could easily jump over it, but they didn't. They seemed to accept it as a boundary. Eventually, they got to where they could tolerate each other. They could be at opposite ends of the living room without fighting. But they never learned to like each other. If worst comes to worst, and your cats keep fighting, you'll have to find a new home for one of them. Cat fights are just too destructive for both them and you to live with. Fear and rage and mixed emotions. I think it's possible wild animals have more complicated emotions, or maybe just more complicated ways of expressing their emotions, than domestic animals because they aren't as neotenized. I say this because human adults have more complicated emotions than human children, so maybe animal adults, which is what wild animals are, have more complicated emotions than neotenized domesticated animals where the adults retain juvenile traits. By the same reasoning, house cats might have more complicated emotions than dogs because they're not as neotenized as dogs. One sign that cats might have more adult-like emotions is that, according to Dr. Overall, cats can be passive-aggressive. When one cat is mad at another cat but is too scared to fight, it will spray to make a passive threat. Or, if a more confident cat threatens a timid cat, the timid cat will spray after the confident cat has left. The timid cat isn't going to risk a direct confrontation. It just says something bad after the other cat has left. Bee Lee, when he didn't get enough attention, would poop right in the center of Mother's pillow. Mother used to call it spite potties. A dog wouldn't do that. Researchers are also finding that elimination disorders often go along with aggression problems. The reason aggression and elimination are associated is that cats use spraying, urinating, and defecating to communicate with each other about a conflict. Because a lot of times cats mark after the threat is over, their owners don't know what happened. If people could read the smells, they'd have a better chance of finding out what their cats are reacting to. The panic system and the social life of cats. Cats are much more social than people realize, and there are lots of individual differences between cats. There would have to be, or cats wouldn't live and interact with humans. One of the most sociable cats I've ever known was my aunt's tomcat, Thomasina, who lived on her guest ranch in Arizona. Thomasina was a regular tiger tabby with black and gray stripes, very friendly and nice, not a scaredy cat. All the guests could pet him. Thomasina was so sociable, he would get in the bathtub with you when it was filled with water. Everybody loved Thomasina. I've also heard lots of stories of cats figuring out how to get their way with people. A lady I met in Illinois told me about her cat, who always wanted to be let out of the house at 5 in the morning. When she and her husband first got him, he would jump on their bed and yowl until someone let him out. She always slept through it. So after a while, the cat knew to wake up her husband, not her. He developed a system of sitting on her husband's chest and tapping him politely on the nose. They were living several hours away from her parents' house, so when they went to visit, they would take the cat with them. Apparently, the cat figured out that the lady's dad was the man of the house there, not her husband. So instead of asking her husband to let him out at dawn, he would jump up on the shelf over her parents' bed and knock things down onto her father's head until he woke up. The cat never knocked anything down on her mother's head, just on her dad's. The social life of cats has been studied in colonies of laboratory cats and, a few times, in free-ranging domestic cats. A cat's social life is somewhat different inside lab colonies versus out in the open, although researchers need more information on how the two compare. Inside labs, cats form status hierarchies. So far, researchers have been finding that linear dominance hierarchies in captive colonies are based on size. The dominant cat gets to eat first. Usually, the dominant cat is the biggest and the oldest, so the dominant cat is mostly going to be male, since male cats are 3.5 times bigger than the females. But it seems likely that females are sometimes the dominant cat. Cat owners have reported having female cats that dominate the male cats in the house. We don't know exactly how the dominant cat gets to be dominant. Dominant cats don't beat up the other cats to maintain their position. Instead, the other cats defer to the dominant cat, although nobody understands why the lower-down cats do this. Researchers assume the dominant cat must be doing some kind of threat behavior humans can't perceive. Also, a dominant cat tends to sit on the highest spot in a room, which might be a signal to the lower cats that they have to defer to it. But it could be the other way around, too. The dominant cat gets to sit on the top shelf because it's dominant. All cats like to sit up high, and the top cat gets the choice spot. Cats get along very well inside captive cat colonies. You can see this easily in small shelters. To a human, it looks like those cats are living in horribly overcrowded conditions. I visited a shelter like that once. There were cats everywhere, dozens of cats in a room the size of an ordinary bedroom. But none of them were fighting, and none of them looked like they had been fighting. A lot of them were cuddled up together. These were all adult rescue cats with different life histories. A lot of them had been abandoned, and some of them had probably been abused. But they were living together peacefully in a small, crowded space.
This ends Disc 3.